want a podcast? I got a Smodcast. You want a podcast? I got a Smodcast. You want a podcast? I got a Smodcast. You wanna. Do you want a podcast? Do you want a show? Do you get your laughs from computer radio with this bro, Scotty Mo? It's about time to lose your shit. Everybody's progress clips for that legend, Kevin Smith.
Welcome to this podcast. I'm Kevin Smith. Okay, man. Today, our guest brings more honor to this house than I'm afraid this house can fucking bear. And if you would have went back to my teenage years and told me that I'd be sitting in this room with this cat, that this cat would come to my house, I would have shit myself. And honestly, it's only because I've learned to contain my fecal matter as an older man that I could keep it in, because it's the same feeling I have now that I would have had then. When somebody called me up and said, hey, this cat is available to do fucking podcasts, I said, please, please send this cat my way, man. Because this cat for my generation represents the first time we literally got to see ourselves on screen. For years, they'd shown us teenagers in movies and TV shows that were in their fucking 40s. John Travolta in Grease was supposed to be a senior. He looked like a senior's dad. So when John Hughes started making movies where the kids looked like the kids, looked like people you went to school with, and more importantly, fucking acted like the people you went to school with, we listened up. Every teenager gets the movies they deserve. Their generation gets the movies they deserve. And our generation was very lucky. There was no streaming. There wasn't a lot of content. Movies were still a thing, and we would go to the movies on Friday nights, Saturday nights, because that was part of the high school tradition, youth tradition growing up. But you'd see, you know, movies where so-called teenagers were slaughtered by Jason Voorhees. They were also in their 30s and shit. You never saw yourself. But then you went to see 16 Candles, and for the first time, you saw people recognizable. And, you know, Cusack's in that movie with another kid, and they're playing like high arch nerds who could never fucking get laid. But Farmer Ted, man, you're like, what's wrong with this guy? Like, why isn't he getting the fucking girl? How come Molly Ringwald's not interested in him? Like, yes, Jake is like football-y looking, but this guy's fucking hilarious. And charm and personality goes a fucking long way, even in high school. So back when I was watching these movies, first it was 16 Candles. Then one of my favorite movies of all time was National Lampoon's Vacation. Then Breakfast Club. Then Weird Science. Then I was a huge Saturday Night Live fan. Then he was the youngest fucking cast member on Saturday Night Live. This cat is a fucking pop cultural lodestar of my entire youth. We crossed over once in the past when I did a podcast for the New York film, New York, God, what was it?
Film Society.
Yeah, New York Film Society, which is at Lincoln Center.
Yeah.
And we were doing a show called Smoviola, and we did the 30th or close to the 30th anniversary of The Breakfast Club, in which every kid was there except for fucking Emilio, who just couldn't fucking be bothered.
Still can't, I think.
His father was screaming at him for fucking, you know, for not getting in more shenanigans in high school. That's why he taped poor Brian's butts together, Brian's friend's butts,
yeah.
Cheeks.
Yeah.
It is with great pleasure and a great honor to welcome to the show one of my favorite fucking performers of my entire life, whose work I can quote chapter and verse, because his work was the foundation of what my work would become. Anything that you wind up doing as a creative is fed by the things that you intake through most of your life. So you will see our guest in little pieces of everything I do, because our guest was in my life before I started doing what I'm most well known for doing. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to fucking Smodcast, Anthony Michael Hall.
Mr. Smith, thank you, sir.
Fucking names. Wow. A man so big, he needs three fucking names.
First of all, bro, I'm just honored to see you again and to be here at your home. And that was really special. Thank you very much for all those kind words.
Your work means the world, and you know that to a lot of people. Bro. Take us back.
Sure.
You're here to talk about, you're in Halloween Kills right now, right?
It's a monster, bro.
It's huge.
Such a fun movie.
And it fucking made money. Like, it was one of those pictures that they were like, we're going to release it in theaters and we're going to release it on Peacock.
Yeah.
And it still killed in theaters.
It did. It's up to, I think, 92 million worldwide. Really thankful for that.
Do you remember?
Much love and thanks to everybody who's seeing the film and running it on Peacock, streaming it multiple times and everything. So
do you remember when the first Halloween came out?
78, man. So I'm 53. I was 10. I didn't catch up on it probably until a year
cable.
Or two later. Right, like Cinemax or HBO in those days, right.
How weird.
So I'm like 11 or 12 probably. So 79 or 80, I remember seeing it.
Are you working at that point? What age do you start working?
I started working when I was 8 years old. I worked.
What was it, like a McDonald's commercial?
You know what it was? I did a play with the late, great Steve Allen.
Are you shitting me?
Yeah. Kevin, check this out. So
where was this?
New York City.
Okay.
It's a friend of my mother's, a guy named Arthur, who was friends with Isaiah Sheffer, really reputable, great theater director from New York.
Mm.
Kind of got us hip to the audition, and that it was an option and something worth exploring. So I had the privilege of meeting Steve Allen at the Waldorf Astoria. I'm 8 years old. This is 1976, man. And I was just a little kid, so I auditioned for him, did that play, wound up being a great experience.
Oh, no, wait. Are you a New York kid?
I'm a New York kid. Yeah.
Whole time? You grew up in New York City?
New York City the whole time.
What do mom and dad do?
Mom is a jazz singer. Singing for our supper, teaches voice as well.
So like literally at night, she'll go to a club and be like, huh, I'm blues and stuff like that. Did you ever go see her perform?
Definitely. I mean, I was in the back of the clubs a lot of times as a kid before we made our way to New York. Yeah, it's crazy.
That is genius.
And then she met my stepfather who wound up adopting me, Tom, and we lost him a couple of years ago to brain cancer, my father. And I always called him my father because he was just exemplary, you know, great husband to my mom and a great father to my sister and I. So anyway, back to Steve Allen. So that was the first gig. I was 8 years old. I did a play, Summer Stock. It was like New York, Cape Cod, Playhouse in the Park.
Why? You know? Why you?
I don't know what he saw in me because I was such a pup, man.
Why did your mom even bring you in? Or
you know what? I was kind of a handball kid. I was one of those kids doing shows for his relatives. You know, my start was in kitchens at weddings and funerals, right? Imitating my aunts and uncles.
You were living room funny.
Oh, totally. That's what I, you know, as a kid. So I remember that. My mom was one of 13 kids, Kevin.
What? Hold on. Let's go back to that.
13 kids.
Your mother?
Yeah. Big Irish Italian Catholic family.
Wow.
Born in Boston, raised there the first couple of years. Then she went west to pursue her singing career. It was kind of like Alice Doesn't Live Anymore. She was a single mom. Well, single mom with a little kid going across country.
You were Tommy.
Totally. So cut back to New York, 76. I'm 8 years old. I did this play. I auditioned for Steve Allen. Didn't know what I was doing. Didn't even know what an audition was. And then from that, man, it became kind of a hobby. I would do commercials and audition. And I had this work ethic, even though I was a kid growing up in the city. So she meets my father.
Where did you go to school in the city?
I went to public schools, man. I went to
PS. You weren't even like the fame kid?
No, none of that.
Dancing on cars.
I wound up going to that school. It's fun.
Did you?
Yeah. I went to public schools as an elementary school.
LaGuardia or something? What is
it? It was LaGuardia, but it was actually PCS, Professional Children's School, which sounds super goofy, but it was that school in high school I went to. It became LaGuardia.
It
merged with another school. But so, yeah, man, so I was growing up in New York City. Then we had, you know, my mother remarried. So I had my sister who's now living in New York with her family.
Mm.
And, you know, I was doing auditions for commercials and just kind of, I auditioned, this goes back to, this is around the time of The Wake, which was the Stephen Allen play. I auditioned for On Golden Pond.
Are you shitting me?
That's how far
for the
back.
Role that, what's his name?
Doug McKeon did. Yeah.
This is the kid who introduced the term suck face to the vernacular that then. Henry Fonda was like, you want to make out or you want to suck face?
So that's one of my earliest kind of professional memories because I was in Midtown with my stepfather auditioning for that. I'm like 9 or 10 years old, maybe a couple years later.
And that part, if I remember, that kid was a little older.
It was. And that's exactly what happened. So it led to Mark Rydell, who was a man. She was a great guy. He wound up taking the time to come and talk to me as a little kid so I didn't feel damaged and all that.
Like it ain't you.
Yeah.
You want something
exactly. And that's literally what he said to me. It's funny you said that. So that's kind of early memories. Then from like 9 or 10 years old, I'm just a little tyke, you know, I'm auditioning, doing, and it was like an after school hobby and shit, but I had this work ethic. I'd actually get on the bus or the train and go to auditions in Midtown and I was, you know, hitting the pavement.
Did you have, what were your friends like? Were they acting
my
kids?
My friends were all kids in school. Yeah. Friends I went to school with, kids in the neighborhood. Yeah.
But not like, we all want to act.
No, it's not that. Yeah. Yeah. Cause you know, New York City upbringing is interesting, man. A lot of people look at it and they shudder. They go, I don't know if I can raise my kids here.
But you were there for what part of the city?
Upper West Side.
So you were there for like fucking the birth of rap.
Totally.
The advent of like fucking Madonna hits the scene.
All
like,
of that.
Wow. That's
hip hop. Totally. Yeah. So New York City upbringing, man. I lived there till I was 25 and then I moved west. So then the career kicked in after that. I was a young teenager, as I said. I did this movie Six Pack with Kenny Rogers, 1980.
Was that your first flick?
Yeah, it was the first big one. Yeah.
I saw that flick in the theater. What's her name? Diane Lane.
Yeah.
So you were one of the kids.
Yeah, man. And then I did a couple of commercials. You know, like, what did I do? Movies of the week. And,
what was Kenny Rogers? Do you remember anything about Kenny Rogers?
Kenny Rogers was great, man. He really had a heart of gold. He really cared about people. Very nice guy, man. Mm. Very down to earth. Very generous of spirit, you know. So then it leads to something that changed my life as I'm looking at National Lampoon here in your office. Yeah. I meet Maddie Simmons and the great Harold Ramis. I'm 14 and I auditioned for Vacation.
So this is before even 16 Candles.
Correct. And so that first period of, let's say, 8 to 13 or 14, I'm just a kid living in the city.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was a hobby and it kind of spun out, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
So I meet Maddie Simmons, the founder of National Lampoon magazine, and Harold Ramis was directing a new comedy called Vacation from a short by John Hughes.
Yeah, John Hughes wrote the short story.
That's right. He was one of those writers
at
Lampoon.
Family Vacation 68 or something.
Right. And Lampoon magazine, as you and I know, it was a great kind of R-rated guys magazine in the 70s and 80s, right? And
it was like there was Mad Magazine,
right.
You know, for more like, I wouldn't say kids, but
right.
High school. But National Lampoon was like when you got to college. It was predicated on the old Harvard and still consistent Harvard Lampoon. Then a few of them, when they graduated, started
exactly.
This magazine.
Exactly.
And then a few years into the magazine very successful.
Right.
One of its most famous covers is buy this magazine or we'll shoot this dog. It was a photo of a dog with a gun to his fucking head. And
right.
Fucking half the nation was outraged. How quaint when
right.
You think about that now. What outrages the nation, but that did outrage the nation.
Great point. So they were pushing the envelope as a magazine
very
that then
so.
Became a branded film company.
Which right. They did right. With Animal House.
Animal House was the first big
hit. Animal House out there, and suddenly they branded a movie, National Lampoon's Animal House.
Right.
Mad Magazine would try it later on with Mad Magazine's Up the Academy, and they would eventually take their name off of it.
Great recall. I remember all that. Right.
Crazy, but they followed that mold. So National Lampoon is then in the movie biz, tangentially, and they're like, all right, we've got this great story that John Hughes, who is already becoming a factor. His name, he's written the movies he'll go on to make that has Anthony in them.
That's
and
right.
They're waiting to go.
And prior to that, Kev, he had written Mr. Mom,
yes.
And Nathan Hayes,
yes.
Which is kind of a little
I
scene.
I fucking love
you
Nathan,
love Nathan Hayes.
Hayes. Yes. It's a movie. I haven't heard anyone
awesome.
Say that fucking title out loud in over a decade.
So those were the
greatest
first two
adventure movies ever made.
Yeah. One of the first two scripts that he sold.
Tommy
Mr. Mom
Jones
and that one.
It's so fantastic. Yeah. Mr. Mom, that's right.
Yeah.
I remember watching the death out of that, man.
Keaton was great in that.
Keaton
right?
Was fucking fantastic. You gave a baby chili? What
225,
crazy?
Whatever it takes.
Yes. So Hughes is on his way up. He wrote a Jaws script, Jaws 3, People Nothing.
Him talking about that, yeah.
So he's becoming a factor, and
right.
Soon Paramount will let him direct his own movie.
Yes, sir. So back
but
to
right
the room.
Right now, he's writing, he writes the screenplay?
Right, he's writing articles, then he gets the commission from Maddie to write the screenplay. So cut to the office in New York. I'm in Warner Brothers in Midtown Manhattan, right near Rockefeller Center. And in the room is just Maddie and Harold, because I didn't meet him on the Vacation experience, which is
right.
Interesting, right? And then we make that film, which was just a gas, man. We could talk for two
Wait,
hours.
You Vacation. Say you didn't meet Hughes
until 16 Candles, right?
How
so
wild.
He was just the screenwriter. I had no idea who he was, man.
You were saying his words before you met the guy.
You got it.
That's
so
great.
So there's this kind of predestined thing.
Let's take it
us.
Back to fucking Harold Ramis, because Jesus.
Okay, another genius.
Yes.
Right?
I
like,
mean,
seriously.
A fucking living legend. This
really?
Is one of the original members of Second City and
right.
SCTV.
Right.
Who went on, of course, to be Egon in Ghostbusters, amongst
right.
other things. But yeah, he was a director and he directed the shit out of fucking Vacation.
And had penned and also directed some of the biggest comedies for our age group, like growing up, man. Stripes, Meatballs, right? All these great movies. And he was brilliant. And actually, you know what? When I think back, Kevin, they had a lot of similarities. Just gentle, nice guys. They loved to laugh, obviously. Were great comedians, comic writers, rather. But when I look back in my mind's eye, I see them both smiling.
All the time.
Because they were just, there was a sense of joy. It's like you with your work, man. If you're doing the thing you do and you love it, then you'll never work a day, right?
And they were like, I'm getting away with it. Like, I can't believe I'm writing the shit. These cats were writing what they wanted to write.
Exactly.
Some writers, lucky enough to get in this business, they're like, you write some shit you don't relate to.
Right.
These cats were writing, like, their own experiences, their own laughs, and changing the shape of the culture.
Yes.
Changing the shape of storytelling and comedy in specific. Both of those
Well
guys.
Said. Absolutely. And they share that. Whereas the only difference I would suggest was that Harold worked in teams. John pretty much wrote alone.
Right.
But absolutely, man. They were both major significant writers and filmmakers of our generation, right? And then wrote, like, particularly Harold, like, he had written, like, all those films all the way up to Ghostbusters. So So anyway, so I got vacation. Audition. Yeah. And they just saw something in me, man. I was rusty in the room. It was
Rusty in the room. Which in any other situation, be like, rusty in the room, they'll get you the job. Room, get you the job.
Well, I just read, you know, it was just from the gut, you know, it's just.
Who were your
thought of acting at that
contemporaries point? At that point? Like, who are you always up against for parts?
You know, it's only, I would see Rick Schroeder. I would see,
The Ricker.
Yeah. There's a,
an and actor. He was at an awkward time too, because he'd had,
The Champ. He'd have the one I was up for. The Champ.
Were you up for The Champ?
Yeah, dude. That's when we go back. So I would see Rick at auditions.
Were you able to cry for your audition?
Yeah,
for the
I
champ?
Did that audition too.
Don't die, funny. Champ.
Those are the most two indelible, you know, memories of auditioning on Golden Pond and The Champ. Totally, man.
Yeah. And also auditioning and not getting him too as a kid.
Yeah.
Cause it's like, it's tough enough as an adult in this business. Oh, where you're like, you. I want to do a thing.
Oh, yeah.
And they're like, we chose somebody else. You're like, all right, I get it.
No
I get
doubt.
It.
No
but
doubt.
As a fucking child.
Well, and also that's why I often like in our careers in this industry, it's like you have to have the mindset of an athlete, man. Because you have to learn. You have to have a thick skin. You got to go season by season. You know, you're never promised anything. You know, you're only as good as your last whatever.
This part of this aspect of you always blows my mind because, of course, I identify you with the early work. And no part of that screams sports aficionado who could make a reference to sports. By the time we get to Johnny B. Goode, it becomes clear that you're acting, that you're not Farmer Ted, that you're not Brian Johnson, that you have a whole other life where you're actually a person playing a part.
But you're speaking to hustle. At the same time, there's no guarantees. You're as good as your last win or victory or last team, last project. Very so true. The analogies are there. But yeah, man, so I've always had that mindset, Kevin, just of like, just keep going. Just don't give up, man. Don't
so wait, so Ramis is like, this is our guy.
I guess so, because I just remember, again, I'm 14, man. I was just a pup. So I remember leaving the room feeling good because Maddie was a very warm-hearted guy. He was great in the room. And Harold, you can see him. Like, just imagine him in Ghostbusters. You see him smiling in your eyes, right?
Like, you hear him on vacation. He's like, we're all done here, Mr. Wally. Should we take him away? He does the voiceover real brief.
Exactly.
So at that point, you don't even, do they do shit like chemistry reads? Or like, we want you to read with Chevy?
None of that for vacation, but come 16 Candles, I'm in Midtown Manhattan on 57th Street at the Universal offices, and that was their process. So I remember being brought back in for the audition for 16 Candles, like literally like 6 or 8 times. And it was that thing is with each successive meeting, there was like 2 more executives in the room.
Right.
This is before, you know, they would hop on a plane or there was, you know, this is long before Zoom. And
but what
people actually showed up and were in the meetings.
You know? Why they're in that room, though, is because they keep hearing about the boy King. They're like, there's this fucking kid. You gotta see. And like, they got him in, Warner Brothers has him in vacation. We got a chance to get him for the next fucking
thing.
You're
very sweet, bro. But it's also that thing of mixing and matching, because you're right. That's what they do. Jackie Birch, to this day, I love her.
Casting
lady, great lady, couldn't be cooler. She was doing that thing. And as you know, as a filmmaker and producer, like, you mix and match contenders, as it were, in the final stages. And that's sort of like pre-screen test or in place of screen test, I guess, sometimes, you know. So
what do you remember meeting Chevy Chase for the first time?
It had to be on the set of the movie.
How did he treat you?
Well, he was cool.
As a kid?
I mean, I always looked up to him. Again, like Rusty, I had that.
You watched him on TV?
Oh, totally, because I love Caddyshack. I remember even seeing him in like movies like Seems Like Old Times. Oh, that we were kids.
Movie. Oh, yeah, great movie. Neil Simon movies. Fantastic. Yeah. Him and Goldie Hawn. That's actually one of his greatest roles.
But also as a kid watching, you know, because we're the same age, like watching SNL, man. Yeah. It was like a treat. You had to ask your parents to stay up. And it was all born
says
of their
the
politics,
guy,
right?
The guy that eventually gets on that show.
Right on. But you know what I mean? It was like a big deal to watch SNL.
Yeah.
So I love Chevy from that. I love Bill Murray. I love Belushi. All those guys. I looked up to all of them, man.
What was it like to bounce off him? Like the scene, like, you know.
On vacation,
The timing is fucking impeccable. She's got 12 cents, Dad. Like your conversations with him are so fucking natural. And even like the scene where he sits down just like, you know, have the beer with you and whatnot. Yeah. And you fucking drink the beer. And you're like, Dad.
Monument Valley, yeah.
You, like Bugs Bunny. You always seem to be way ahead of whoever you're in the scene with and stuff. And it's funny in that scene because he's the adult and clearly you're aged up and whatnot.
You're very kind, sir.
Was he, do you rehearse on a thing like that? Or,
you know, I remember.
Are you, is that you pure? Like,
that's
when
just me pure.
That scene,
yeah,
that's
no, that's
like,
just me pure. I mean, I was aware of the timing and I would be goaded on.
Fucking swag, bro.
Thank you.
Like,
bro.
there's a swag to that performance where it's like, this fucking kid knows what's going on.
I appreciate it, man. But, and so I was goaded by. Just looking over and seeing Harold smile or just being happy. You know, you always want to please the director. I had that same relationship with John and it went to another level because we were like brothers. But with Harold, same thing, man. It was always there on the page. It was always funny. But he would, you know, you would check in. It's that thing. You know how it is when you're directing your actors and you can get on the nonverbal thing almost where it's like, let's do another one or let's try something else.
And you're at, so how old are you when you're doing Vacation?
14.
I mean, all right.
Yeah.
What does that do to your social life? Vacation shoots where? California?
Well, here's the trip, because this predates blue screen, green screen.
Yeah, you have to actually go to a fucking place.
So the whole crew, we did the schlep, man. We went to Colorado. We left L.A., rehearsed at Warner's, and then made that trip as a unit.
Are you shitting
me? We went from Colorado to Arizona and then back to L.A., the whole crew.
That's
great.
Fucking crazy, it was great, man. That's wild. So is there a... I guess there's like a bonding that goes on with that.
Yeah, no, totally. Like, I wasn't hanging with Chevy because I was still a kid, but he was, to your first question, he was cool, man. He was always kind of snarky and super, you know, Chevy. What's interesting about Chevy's background, I think his acting career took him by storm, where you could argue the other cast members of the 70s cast were like really, they came from Second City or whatever they did. But with Chevy, he was the head writer, and I think it was kind of like...
On the Lampoon Tour.
Right.
On Lemmings. He was a writer, and then he became a performer, but he wasn't expecting stardom.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And I think that if you look at it through that lens, it's interesting, because it does change it. Because I remember as a kid, he would mention, like, a great actor to him, and I love this guy. It's like Ted Knight.
Right.
Because he loved Ted Knight, because Ted Knight had a rubbery face. I remember hearing Chevy say things like that.
About, right.
But it's not like you look at his career and then Murray's career.
Yeah.
Just clearly wanted to make more movies, right?
Yeah,
there's a real arc there.
Or easier to get along with could be a thing, too. There's that as well.
There you go.
What is the... so when 16 Candles starts happening, did you get a feeling like Hughes was familiar with you before you even read, because he'd seen Vacation?
He was. You just said it spot on. That's exactly right. So I was on his radar, so to speak, but we just hit it off right away. I mean, we literally just hit it off. It was probably like you and Jason and the boys. Like, it was just...
And how much older is he than you?
He's 35. I'm 15. But it was like we were both 15.
That's what people say about him. So is it true he would give you guys mixtapes or tell you, like, literally, this is what your characters would...
Literally. Because in his house, Kevin, he had a room in Evanston or Northbrook, one of these nice, fancy neighborhoods he lived in. His wife was great, Nancy. She's no longer with us, too, sadly.
She just passed?
Yeah, a couple of years ago. Yeah, she passed.
Are you kidding?
Yeah.
I met her at that thing, event we did. She was lovely, because to me, she's the star of She's Having a Baby. That's Elizabeth McGovern right there.
And Kevin's playing John. You got it.
Yeah.
Bingo, buddy. So back to in the day, like when we were shooting 16 Candles, like his two sons, who are now grown men with their own kids and families, they were like two little Macaulays, dude. I was like the third son, because I'd be hanging out at his house on the weekend. We'd be watching Laurel and Hardy, Abbott and Costello, and then we would dip into some Pryor and watch Live on Sunset Strip and shit like that. I mean, this is how the relationship was. So to your question, when I look back,
you're
it's
sitting
like we were both 15.
Listen to this. Yeah. You're an icon, you yourself, sitting with another icon, watching other icons work. That's fucking nuts.
I mean, I had no awareness of that, but I appreciate it very much. His process was like, and he even would say to me, you have to write about what you know. Now, let me just point out one thing, which is kind of the brilliance of John Hughes, if anything else, Kevin. Cut to Home Alone later in his career. So how does Macaulay fend off Daniel Stern and Joe Pesci? He's watching Abbott and Costello. So there's the connective point, right?
Nothing's wasted about what you would know. A writer's life, man.
Careful what you say around them.
That's yes. They're fucking thieves as well.
Right.
So you right away, he took a shine to you.
Totally.
What was it? Now, 16 Candles is his first time directing.
Right. And we go back to Chicago, his hometown where he's from.
You guys shot it in Chicago.
In Chicago. Skokie, Illinois, man. Right there.
Is that right?
Yeah. And we used that high school. I forget the name of it.
But it became the fake high school of Shermer, Illinois.
That's it. And that was a fictional name he used for his films.
Because there's a street, I guess, where he lived near or on called Shermer Ave or something like that. So I guess that's where it
became the fictional name of every high school.
Of every high school. Which, like, inspired me. Like, to me, when I watch those movies in theaters and every time, hey, they're wearing Shermer athletic wear in Weird Science. Like, fucking Shermer was referenced in fucking Breakfast Club. Like, holy shit.
Right.
One world, even though these characters never crossed over, that always meant one world to me. So when I've started my shit, I'm like, all my movies are connected.
Great.
Like, they all went to fucking Sherman.
Oh, that's
so
brilliant.
Much. So
I never knew
Dogma,
that. I never knew. That's great.
In Dogma, Jane and Silent Bob go to Chicago literally looking for Shermer, Illinois.
Remember that, man. I auditioned for that project years ago. I remember that movie.
For Dogma?
Yeah, I did. I guess you never got the tape.
Impossible. Impossible.
I swear to you.
Because we would have seen you, man, and I would have been like, oh, he's in.
I guess my agent was fucking lamer than I thought he was.
He'd have to be. Oh, my God. Never in a fucking million years. That's always like the thing when I talk about people I love and whose work I love.
Yeah.
Some people are like, why don't you cast him? I'm like, well, generally speaking, when I made a lot of things, the people I talk about, I love Robert Shaw. A, he was dead. B, he would have been like too old for my shit. But you would have been right on fucking point, man.
Love it, man. Still love to work with you.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's still plenty of fucking time.
There's still time.
All right, so
16 candles. Yeah, so we're in Illinois. It's about 2 years after vacation, so I'm 15 or 16 now.
And Molly Ringwald is not Molly Ringwald yet.
Correct.
She was in like
The Tempest. Cassavetes flick.
Yes. Right? The fucking Cassavetes flick.
Modern day adaptation of Shakespeare's The Tempest.
And great maybe movie, some actually. Like sci-fi flick I think she'd been in.
Space Runners.
That's it. Dude. So she hadn't really done much, and she certainly wasn't the Time magazine cover girl, America's Sweetheart.
Exactly. But she was on John's radar, and he took a liking to her. She was an actress and an ingenue and something, whatever, that he saw in her. But also, in fairness, they were great friends, too.
Of sorts. He wrote for her absolutely. Forever, just like you. The two of you, he spent the most time generating for. Like, he found his voice, or not, he'd found his voice, but he found that his voice could be channeled very well through the two of you. And it's charming.
I have to agree with
that. You, like, as a guy, it makes sense. But it's really special that he had any kind of connection in terms of writing for a girl.
Interesting.
In the 80s.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Right, like, most people weren't thinking that way. And suddenly here was a guy who was like, I'm going to build my whole first movie, not around a male main character, but a female main character whose biggest fucking problem is like, I don't know if I have anybody to go to the prom with.
Now dig this. That's all great points. He was actually intending, and I remember at the time him telling me, he intended to make The Breakfast Club first. So that must have impressed the executives of Universal. And for whatever reasons, they shifted and they went back to, we're going to do 16 Candles first.
Is that right?
Yeah. And then the thing that you just said does apply. It's interesting because why would he write through a girl's point of view? But that was brilliant in hindsight. Then the other thing I would say is they had a great friendship too, man. Like she was very much into like the Velvet Underground, the Beatles. Like she was
a music kid.
Music kid, big time. And John connected with both of us that way through music. So back to his house, he had a dedicated room in his house, Kevin. It was unbelievable. It was just like this, floor-to-ceiling vinyl, and then the desktop in the corner by the window. So that integration of music cues and all that, exactly, that's where he wrote. So that's why it fed him, like you said, as artists, we have to stay inspired. What feeds you comes out in your work subconsciously. That's where he wrote. So all of the music cues in those early films and all of his films, Universal wound up giving him a record label because his instincts were so incredible. So he was discovering bands like Psychedelic Furs and Thompson Twins and all that music.
It's true. We think of him as a channeler of new wave, but he was also a breaker of a lot of new wave as well. He wrote in the liner notes, I want to say, for like The Breakfast Club. It's something that stayed with me forever. Mm-hmm. He wrote something to the effect of, music has never been an afterthought for me. Meaning when he's generating the screenplay, he's dropping song titles in to set a tone and a mood.
Precisely. And I saw it. And he did make mixtapes. And he would give them to us. And he did inspire us. He had an idea for a movie called The Last Good Year, which was to be set in 61, right before the Beatles come over in 62.
Mm-hmm.
He made a mixtape for that. And that was something he was talking through. Or just, we would go to Kingston Mines or these legendary blues places in Chicago. He would pick us up in a limo with his wife. And we'd all go out and hear music. Like, all this kind of stuff. We go to record stores together. All of that was legit.
When you go to record stores together at that point, are people like, oh my God, you're that fucking kid?
No, because I think the movie had just been out, but it did change things. Like all of a sudden I was, you know, recognized, and it freaks you out. You know how it is. Like in your 20s, when you're 15, you're like in the middle of that living the awkward time, you know. But honestly, more importantly than that was just the friendship. We were always laughing, always making each other laugh. He was always turning us all on to new music. Surely that social time was there too, man.
You're a kid, so you would be forgiven for this. But being that you were in Vacation, he wrote it. You were in 16 Candles, he wrote it. You were in Breakfast Club, he wrote it. Did there become a certain expectation of like, I will work with Hughes forever? He will put me in everything. Because there was like that run where it's like him, her.
So check this out. My answer to that is I'll take you to like, we're shooting The Breakfast Club. Now the second film, arguably the third, if you include the Vacation movie,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So now we're shooting The Breakfast Club at whatever high school that was. It had been shut down. We were sharing it with the USFL at the time. Remember the Chicago Blitz? They used to have the USFL. So we were sharing this. We're shooting this, you know, this high school drama in this high school setting.
Mm-hmm.
And between takes, he comes up to me in the hallway and he goes, Mike, check this out. Last night, I started working on this new thing. I go, what are you talking about? He goes, I wrote 30 pages of it last night after we wrapped. It's going to be you and another guy, right? And you guys are going to like invent a girl on the computer.
Oh my God.
And we're in the hallway, Kevin. He's like, and I'm like, dude, we're working. You know how it is. You do 12, 13 hour days. He went home and wrote the
and
first
wrote 30
of
pages yeah.
of Weird Science. So
which is like
incredibly prolific.
Inarguably like a starring role for you. It's like, yes, you and Ilan Mitchell Smith.
Yeah.
Co-stars, but yeah. You know, it was, for all intents and purposes, an Anthony Michael Hall vehicle.
And to drill down on a little more, after we did 16 Candles together, I mean, we're literally buddies. Like, we would literally just call and hang out on the phone and shoot the shit and talk about music and films and whatever. So after wrapping 16 Candles, I get a call. I'm back in school. I'm in my mom's house and shit. I'm like dealing with 10th grade. You know, I'm like
going back to life.
Listening to my Italian Irish mom, like, pick up the fucking, go get the garbage out of the house. You know, whatever. And he calls me and he goes, we're going to do this at the Breakfast Club. So, yeah, that's how it happened. And so at that point, I did have that feeling, to your question. I was like, I just
love
this guy.
Likes me.
I just love the guy. He likes me. We're making each other laugh. I can't believe he's going to keep casting me and employing me. And
where are you living at this point?
Upper West Side, New York City.
When do you move? Do you stay there or throughout all the years?
I didn't move out until I was 18. After I did SNL, then I moved west. Then I wrote a script with Downey and his father. That was I lived and moved to the Chateau Marmont. I had done this film in the same year that I did SNL for that one season, 85, 86, a movie called Out of Bounds for Columbia.
Yes! Yeah, the fucking action movie.
Yeah,
the movie where fucking Anthony Michael Hall goes serious.
You know what I'm saying? I was trying to mix it up. And
it was like
So that's when I moved out to LA.
Like, remember that, for those that listened, the Shia LaBeouf movie, you know, it was like kind of an actioner.
Right.
It was like that. And the way they kind of like positioned Shia LaBeouf at that point is like, hey, he does more than what you're familiar. Right. He's an action guy. Similar I remember intent. With Out of Bounds, it was like, we're going to take this guy and we're going to put him into a fish out of the water story and stuff.
Similar intent.
Good movie. That movie totally fucking worked. Thanks, I saw that fucking shit with the ears, man.
Yeah. So after the three films with John.
Were you scared doing that, though?
I was scared at all of it, man. SNL scared me.
But at least SNL, it's like, I know how to be funny. But like, that's a movie where they're like, you can't rely on your sense of humor. It's about the plot.
Do you know what it is? It's also that thing of, I remember with my father being out here, my stepfather was with me, and we went and had a meeting with the studio head at the time, this guy named Guy McElwain. He was a nice gentleman. And now life is changing. Like, dude, I'm 18. All of a sudden, I'm like with studio heads in Beverly Hills, and they're talking about positioning that film. So I did that film. Just the impetus then was just like, well, try something different.
You know?
They hired a great, cool director, a guy named Richard Tuggle. He had actually worked with Clint. He did Tightrope with Clint Eastwood.
Holy shit.
And he was cool. And I was a pain in the ass. I was a kid trying to stretch out, and I was doing SNL and
were you,
and
so that you're film shooting in the same SNL year, at the same time?
In the same year. So that my contract with Lorne was reduced from 18 or 22 episodes to like 12 or 13.
And where were you shooting Out of Bounds?
L.A.
So you're doing the flight back
and
forth.
Literally. So I did 13 episodes of SNL, and then they kind of let me out of my contract so I could go do Out of Bounds in L.A. That wraps up, came out, didn't make a big impression at the box office, all good, learning lesson, valuable. But then at that point, I moved out to L.A. And upon arriving in L.A., I'm living at the Chateau Marmont. Downey and I are buddies.
And you guys met on Weird Science.
Yeah.
Because he's one of the jerks.
Right. And I brought him to Lauren's attention. He wound up, everybody saw what he had right there. And SNL.
Is that right?
That's legit. Yeah, because I introduced him to Lorne.
So he gets the bridge to SNL for RDJ.
Yes, sir.
Is AMH.
Correct.
Wow.
Correct. So then we do that season.
For those that don't follow or haven't followed or weren't around for that season of SNL, Anthony Michael Hall, Robert Downey Jr.,
Dennis Miller.
Dennis Miller begins
Randy
there. Randy Quaid is still saying
Nora
there.
Dunn.
Nora
Dunn. Terry Sweeney.
And Joan Cusack as
well. Yes, sir.
Crazy cast.
Yeah.
It was the first time that Lorne had returned after an absence, and he was also like, you know what? I can bring familiar faces into this cast. They don't have to be not ready for primetime players. They'll be not ready for primetime players, but they don't have to be unknowns.
Perfect. Duly noted.
So I remember when you got cast, it was huge for us as kids because you were like the youngest fucking cast member. As somebody who loved SNL, I was like, if that fucking kid could get on, there's a chance.
That means a lot to
me.
Thank you.
But at the same time, it was like, yes, but that fucking kid is Anthony Michael Hall. You were absolutely like in a fucking class all your own. One could look at you and be like, oh shit, one of us. But one could not look at you and be like, oh, I could do that. Like, people can look at my first film, Clerks, and be like, oh shit, I can make a movie about talking to my friends. Nobody could look at like your first three fucking performances and be like, oh, I can act. Like, it's, and especially in, like, I know you're much older now, but especially in hearing you talk, because you are a different person than every fucking character.
Thanks.
Even back then, probably as a kid, you weren't like Farmer Ted.
I was probably the most like Farmer Ted. It's funny. I've thought about this in recent weeks by doing all these interviews for Halloween Kills. To me, it's almost like Farmer Ted leapfrogs into Gary.
Yeah.
Weird Science. It's the same. Because I was
yes,
a funny
very,
kid.
Very, very
you know
true.
I mean?
Very
gangly,
true.
Funny, sarcastic. I had that, you know, that capacity. And I'm just grateful, man, that they saw something in me. So,
you
yeah, so back to LA.
You bring RDJ into yeah. it. And your season, you get let out early so you can go make
out of bounds for Columbia.
But then the friendship, when you move out to LA, you start working on Johnny B. Goode with him and his dad.
Before that, we wrote the script, which is really funny. So we get together in LA, and for a couple of years leading up to that, I became aware of his father, Downey Sr., who just passed.
He's a filmmaker
yeah,
as well.
He was
he
a
did Putney Swope.
Yeah, just a legendary. You know how I would also qualify, like, categorize his talent? He was almost like the Lenny Bruce of independent cinema.
Yeah, I would agree.
Right? Like, just a brilliant satirist.
Great
brilliant. Yeah,
yep.
Incredible. And he became a friend. He was great. And I love Downey Sr. And so Robert suggested.
God, you chummed around with a lot of adults.
Yeah, I did.
But
exactly.
That's what happens
yeah.
in this yeah. business. If you're like, yeah. and I don't mean that in a pervy way.
No,
just
no.
like
yeah.
you wound up hanging out with adult intellectuals as well.
Totally. Oh, totally. I got more on that with the Chateau. I have an interesting memory that just came to me. Let me go back to the script.
Do it.
So Downey goes, let's write the script. So we meet at the Chateau Marmont because I'm living there. Downey's living with Sarah Jessica Parker right down Sunset at a house ironically owned by Chaplin. Before he makes Chaplin.
Oh, shit.
Yeah, yeah. And it's right where the Park Hyatt is, like right before the Comedy Store.
Yeah, yeah.
All those little side streets. So dig this. So we write the script. I'll give you the premise, and then I'll just cut to the chase. What Downey said, Senior said to both of us after writing this for 5 weeks. By the way, he would say every day we would convene at the lame table. All right, boys, I'll see you tomorrow at the lame table, which is my room at the Chateau. So we write the script, and after 5 weeks, the setup was pretty funny. He's a coke fiend and I'm an alcoholic. We get in a car wreck and then we wind up at the Resort de Finale. it's like one of these rehab places in Malibu, but not the type in Malibu, but it's actually in Mexico, of course, for no reason at all. So we put that in. I thought that was pretty funny. Anyway, after the
year is this?
This
by
is
the
like 86.
Okay, just to put a pin in it. 86 for a rehab comedy is pretty forward fucking thinking.
Kind of.
Yeah.
Right? And we had just finished SNL. We were just like, man, we don't know what the hell that was, but we had fun. Okay.
Right.
So after 5 weeks, this is the funniest line. Downey Sr. turns to the two of us and goes, fuck this script. He goes, I think the script should be two punk actors and an aging director writing a screenplay at the Chateau Marmont.
It was hilarious.
So it never went anywhere, but we did write the script. I still have it. It's pretty funny.
What is it called?
It's called Seth and McGuigan. He's Seth and I'm McGuigan.
All right. So where does Johnny B. Goode happen then in relation?
Johnny B. Goode was after that. It was 87. And then I got this offer to do this comedy. And the gentleman who wound up directing it had been Robert Downey Sr.'s editor, this guy named Bud Smith, who was like a veteran editor, super cool guy. He got the nod to direct the film. And again, it was actually Downey who had to call me because at the time I had, you know, at that brief moment in time, I had more heat than he did in the business. So he asked me if he could be a part of the film and I had sign off approval. I'm like 19 at the time.
RDJ, Junior.
RDJ. Yeah. And I remember the call and everything. I said, of course, bro. I love you, man. Let's do it. So
you guys were...
So then he joins the cast of Johnny B. Goode.
And you palled around for a couple of years then.
Yeah, man, we've been buddies, yeah. So he was he was really more of an L.A. guy because I lived in New York until I was 25.
Right.
But I would see him all the time. And then we wrote that script. I was staying at the Chateau and he was with Sarah Jessica. Funny stuff, man.
I remember I was talking to my wife, Jennifer, and I was just like, you're never going to believe this, but fucking Andy Michael Hall's coming. Or she was like, I never like to see anybody. She's like, but I actually would... poke my head in and say hello for that. But we were talking about, I was doing the because she was talking about God, remember he was so wispy and he got big. And I was like, he had that glow up.
Wispy.
In pop culture, yeah. We all got to see it because there was a generation of us that grew up watching you be
the scrawny version.
Scrawny
yeah.
kid. Then Edward Scissorhands
yeah.
happens.
Yeah, yeah.
And suddenly you become huge. Did you have a growth spurt or something?
You know what it was? I hired a guy named Tom Patty who literally I had met. Okay, so watch this. This is all connection. It's really funny. It's like the 6 degrees of me. I know Bacon's got a game, but I could do it. So watch this, Kev. So I'm doing Johnny B. Goode and I hire this guy. So after making The Breakfast Club, Paul Gleason, my great friend.
Gleason, who was
Dean
the
Vernon.
Dad
yeah.
Paul Gleason, who was Dean Vernon in The Breakfast Club.
Right.
Ball, you get the horns.
Right,
yes.
Right, right. From Breakfast Club and a lot of other films, Trading Places, a lot of great work. He was a good buddy, man. He was awesome. He takes me to see Tyson at the Garden. Tyson and I become friends. This is like 1986, okay? So back to, okay, so Johnny B. Goode. So then I get Johnny B. Goode, and through Tyson, I met a guy named Tom Patty, who's a friend. Mm. And he was the last fighter along with Tyson to be trained by Customato at the house in the Catskills.
Okay.
So I called Tom up, and I asked him to kind of train me like a fighter for this football movie. So that's when it happened, Kevin.
Then, Johnny B. Goode.
Bro, I went to his house in Stockton, California, where he grew up. We stayed with his parents, and this dude would wake me up at 3 o'clock. I'd be swinging a tire, like a sledgehammer on a tire.
So like that shit working out today.
Oh, totally. Doing the Rocky shit. Like I put on 30 pounds in like 6 or 8 weeks because I trained like a fighter for that film.
For Johnny B. Goode.
Correct. And then after that, I did Scissorhands. And then from that, I just bulked up.
So technically, right, the glow up was in Johnny B. Goode.
Correct. The training for it, which I put on, it was intentional. I said, I want to gain 30 pounds and get bigger.
But Johnny B. Goode didn't connect with the public as much as Edward Scissorhands.
Clearly so
most
not.
People right. fucking... think of like Same that man. Was the first moment where right. they're like, oh my god, like right. this guy got fucking huge,
right? And the truth is, all in all fairness, no, not to disparage Johnny Depp, but he's kind of a smaller guy, so I also kind of dwarfed true. him, but I think
that's true.
Sorry, Johnny, but I also
yeah, you want to talk about wispy, particularly yeah. back then and stuff.
But a virtuoso actor, we love him, right? I mean, but I also think
performance,
like,
your performance yeah. in that movie is fucking frightening. Thanks. Like for a guy that we grew up loving and identifying with, I'll never, there's a shot in the movie where you're fucking pointing
right.
and he's got like finger right in camera and you sound so fucking harsh, like a real high school fucking bully and shit. And that was like the moment where I was like, oh my God, everybody fucking underestimated this guy. He wasn't one fucking flavor, one color of the crayon. He can flip the fucking script.
I appreciate it. And what was interesting is going back, when I roll back the time and I think about it, I met with Tim Burton, and Tim Burton was so cool, dude. I think Tim Burton, I have a theory that he is Scissorhands, and I'll get to that in a second. But I met with him, and I think he thought right away it would be interesting to kind of flip it.
All right.
Right? Because obviously for the last 4 years, I'd done these four comedies, Vacation, then The Three with John.
It had only been 4 fucking years prior to Scissorhands?
Well, in fairness, no, I did Scissorhands in 1990. So from 83 to 90, in 7 years, I did those four movies that all came out and, you know, did this.
Maybe
thing.
It's because, I wonder if like the rest of-
Because I was 20 when I
the world- film. Sees it through the same prism. But those movies are like so huge and loom so large in at least my personal mythology that I assume it goes the way for everybody else. But also I don't think it's just me. Like those movies were so culturally fucking important. Vacation, so much so that they made a bunch of those fucking movies. All the Hughes stuff. So yeah, man, that's like,
right. And then the three in a row with John were all
part made. Of that. It's yeah. not even like, yeah. I was lucky enough to be in it. You're a fundamental battery in that shit.
Thank
like,
you, man.
Yeah. You know, it's incredible. So that blows my mind. That's only seven yeah. fucking years.
Vacation's 83, comes out in 84. And from 84 to 86, I do three movies in a row with John in 2 years.
Unbelievable.
And then that brief period of like Johnny B. Goode was after that. So Scissorhands, 1990, Tampa, Florida.
God, and we go you, to shoot that you movie. Crammed so much life into 10 fucking years.
I joke man, with my wife too and friends, like it took me the following 20 years to process the first 20 years of my life.
You would imagine.
Right? Because well, I mean, 15 to 20 was like wild.
And think about yeah, it. You fundamentally yeah. didn't have the teenage, you were playing a teenager we all identified with, living a life that none of us could possibly identify.
And had taken basically a huge time out from my own teenage life to yeah. then go to work. But at the same time, I really was that age. I was the age I was playing, which is also kind of interesting, you know?
Fucking
it's
nuts.
Fun, man. Yeah.
What, when you get to episodic, like when you do Dead Zone.
Yeah.
What is that like to go from like, all right, I just have to learn my character for 120 pages. Now I'm working on a thing where 3 seasons from now, they could tell me this whole time I've been dead. And I'll be like, wait a second. I wasn't playing that. Like, what the fuck?
Well, the first thing I would add to that was I went through my 20s just struggling. So like, honestly, episodic television, you know, doing things like Murder, She Wrote, Touched by an Angel, Diagnosis Murder. And you know what, man? In all fairness, these were great experiences as well, Kevin, because just like for you, I'm sure directing commercials, like the value in the work is no less important. And it's not lost on you too, because you're like, yo, if I'm not in a big movie now, like when I got those TV shows, that was a big fucking deal.
So it's like you right. got to work with Angela fucking Lansbury.
And there's the other
Dick Van Dyke. Right. And these are names working with that legends were huge people that are- for like you were growing exactly. up with these names. So it wasn't exactly. even like, oh, these are old people in the business too. You exactly. were like, I grew up watching this motherfucker.
Exactly. So basically in a few paragraphs, that's my 20s, right? And then I get the Dead Zone.
Where are you living in your 20s? Here
in LA. I moved out here when I was 25.
Copy that.
Right. So by the time Dead Zone comes along, I'm now in my early 30s. I've kept alive. I'm surviving. I'm making a career and, you know, making a living, still doing my thing, mostly on television. And then the Dead Zone came up, and it was a gentleman named Michael Piller who created the show. He was a guy, he was a wonderful guy, man. He started out in Standards and Practices. And he wanted.
Are you kidding?
Yeah.
For those that don't know what that is, that's the person at the network that's like, you can't say this.
You can't say this. You can't say this.
If this is too far, and they trim it out. So
yes, sir.
That dude started doing that job.
Right. So in the 70s, he's doing that. Next thing you know, he aligns with the great Gene Roddenberry, and he creates Deep Space Nine, Voyager, and kind of becomes a self-taught writer. So
Holy
he becomes
shit.
A showrunner, executive producer. I mean, talk about a self-made man like yourself.
Fucking A.
So he was awesome. So he gave me the Dead Zone. And I won't mention what name, agency, but they originally turned it down on my behalf. And it was because he was persistent. It was a classic kind of agency story. You get lost in the shuffle sometimes.
Right.
And then after his second or third attempt, I was offered the Dead Zone. Yeah. And then the other thing, the thing that happened before that really drew his attention is when I played Gates. So he had seen me play Bill Gates. Noah Wiley played Steve Jobs.
Oh, my God. I fucking love that movie.
Thanks, man. Pirates,
the Pirates of Silicon Valley. Yeah, that is so fucking good. I went, there was a time where it wasn't available streaming. I went and bought that shit a bootleg copy on fucking eBay.
Thank you.
So that we can watch it all the time. Me and the wife fucking love that movie. I forgot about that film.
Right. So Mr.
That was like a TNT movie.
Correct.
Or something.
Exactly.
Yeah. One of their first time they spent a bunch of money on
it. You got a great memory.
Shit.
Exactly. So
you
basically
fucking him too. That was a great performance.
Thank you. So that's 1999. So Michael Piller sees that and gives me the
Wait a second. What do you do for that performance? Do you have to fucking like not work out for a minute?
Well, totally that thing. Yeah. I mean, I've always been lazy with working out anyway. So it wasn't a big thing, but basically I worked with a great coach named Steve Bridgewater who coaches in the past has worked with Pitt and Depp and other people. He was a friend of the producer named Nick Lombardo.
You got his voice too. The way he goes up when he talks like this.
Yeah. And so what we did, Kev, is we worked for 6 weeks before I started to film, and he was like my private coach for that movie.
Right.
And that's what we did. And the funniest shit is the day one of our first session at TNT, we're in the conference room, the big table, it's like 14 chairs, and he and I at the end looking at each other, and he breaks out a legal pad. He goes, Mike, we're going to set a list of goals. And I'm like, this dude's thinking like Bill Belichick, or like, he's like looking at it like a coach, right? It's killer. First goal, what he goes, and he looks at me, Kevin, he goes, do you want people to see you or Bill Gates? You know what I said, right? I go, Gates. Second goal, I go, dude, like on a whim, I go, I want the film to be nominated for some Emmys. Turns out, though, it was nominated for 5 Emmys. Yeah. So I had no, you know, so it was really just about him kind of sort of teaching me to train my mind to set goals.
Fucking A.
Isn't that cool? So then from that, Mr. Piller saw me and gave me the Dead Zone. So 2 years later, I'm shooting the pilot for Dead Zone. Up in Vancouver.
Vancouver has one of my work shows.
Yeah.
Get out of here. Yeah. Is she Canadian?
Yeah. Right. She actually is Slovakian, but she had moved from her country to Canada. And she was living in Vancouver.
So not only did you get a cool job, you got a cool rest of your life.
You're not kidding. I'm a lucky man.
Man, I forgot. When you're leaving, I'm going to go watch fucking Pirates.
It's all good,
man.
Yeah, that was a pretty good movie.
I love that movie. Yeah. It was really well done.
Martin Burke, the director.
And I remember the, you know, years ago, what's his fuck? Did a,
what's his fuck?
Aaron Sorkin did a, you know,
he did the Jobs movie. Jobs.
Which, you know, wonderful, but like, I prefer Pirates. We've seen iterations of his story, but I've always preferred like that version of it and how they kind of, charted both of your stories separately, then crossed them over and stuff. It's like you got two movies out of that movie.
Yeah, no, I appreciate it. Yeah, it's interesting. When you watch Jobs, you can almost tell that he watched Pirates of Silicon Valley, right? But I love Sorkin. What a great writer.
Did you ever hear from Gates?
This is so funny, Kevin. I had the balls for some reason. I decided to call Gates at Microsoft and request a meeting. About what? I would have no fucking idea, nor would I. So I get a call back from a guy named, now this is so funny because he had the identical name of this great comedian. You'll remember this guy, John Panette. Remember that?
Yeah, dude.
He was great.
Do the high voice stuff.
Right? People are like, are you this fat? No, I just blow myself up before the fucking, before I come out here.
Yes.
The guy was great. But anyway, it was a Microsoft employee who happened to be named John Panette. And the guy calls me back one day. I'm at home like fucking off. I don't know what I was doing. Bring, we could pick up the phone. Mr. Hall, John Panette, I work for Mr. Gates. And I'm like, mic drop. I'm like, oh shit, this is crazy. He got the message somehow, right? So he goes, unfortunately, Mr. Gates doesn't have time in his schedule to meet with you, but he wanted you to know that he really appreciates all the comments on the ramp up to the release of Pirates of Silicon Valley. And I went, bingo. Because, dude, I was just doing it on a whim. I was just doing it to see if he'd call me back. I did that with Nicholson once. He did.
He called you back?
Nicholson called me back, but also so did Gates' office. It was pretty cool.
What did Nicholas, so you just called Nicholson to be like, is Anthony Michael Hall? I'm a fan.
Well, when I met him, it was through Kelly LeBrock. I was doing Weird Science, right, and I was offered Full Metal Jacket. So Kelly, who's still a friend.
Wait. You can't roll over shit like that so fucking fast. So wait a second. Because of Kelly LeBrock, you know Kelly LeBrock, and because you know Kelly LeBrock, you get to meet Jack Nicholson. But who offers you Weird Science? But where does this Full Metal Jacket come in?
I'm shooting Weird Science, and I get a call from Marty Bauer, who's a great legend of our business. He was one of the founders of what became UTA. Mm-hmm. Took me on when I was 15 after 16 Candles. And he tells me, look, Stanley Kubrick, I can remember the call. He goes, Stanley Kubrick is interested in you for this to play a platoon member in his upcoming Vietnam epic. And I was like, great. Okay, cool. Next day, he calls me back. He goes, actually, he's interested in you for the lead. He's going to call you tomorrow.
So you've been Joker?
Oh, no, dude. Yeah, totally. So watch what happens. I get up at like 7 o'clock. The call's going to be at 9. I'm staying at the Sheraton Premiere next to the Universal Tour, right, which is where we were like placed because Universal had to deal with them, right?
Right.
So I'm there pacing the room, Kevin. I'm like, oh, shit. He's telling Kubrick going to call. It's like fucking meeting the Wizard of Oz, right? Mm. You're like, oh, shit, this is crazy. Bring. I pick up the phone. Stanley? He goes, Michael, this is Stanley Kubrick. And I'm speaking like a deep guttural voice, literally like the Wizard of Oz, right? He goes, I just screened 16 Candles 3 times. And then he pauses. I was like, making a fucking what the fuck face, right? He goes, and I have to tell you this. Michael, I think you're my favorite actor I've seen since I saw Jack in Easy Rider. Dude, I was like, he literally said that to me, Kevin.
Stanley Kubrick said that to you.
I swear to you. And it blew me away to this day. The only reason I mention it is because I love Stanley Kubrick and I love him. Not to tout, you know, blow my own horn.
I didn't know humble brag. Amazing, that's a true story.
Yeah, isn't that crazy? But here's how it got deeper. Then he started talking about the great Russian director Eisenstein and Chaplin, because I'd asked him some of who his influences were. And he also mentioned a German director, a famous guy from the 20s. I can't remember his name. It was an interesting phone call, man. It was really interesting. So he offers me Full Metal Jacket. So then my father happened to be on the West Coast still. I had to go to his attorney's house, a gentleman named Louis Blau, who literally lived on the same street in Bel Air as the fucking, where the Beverly Hillbillies house was. Like, and for those who don't know Bel Air, it's like the upper echelon of Beverly Hills. It's like,
yeah, it's a gated community.
Old school money, very wealthy to do area in Hollywood. Anyway, so I went to his house with my father, and he was an older gentleman at that time. And this is 1986. And he leads me to the kitchen, and I sit down. I read a numbered script, and it said on the cover page, I never forgot, it was a silhouetted drawing of a bunch of paratroopers like landing. And he had kind of melded two projects, the Short Timers and Dispatches, were two books that Stanley optioned that became the basis of what became the screenplay for Full Metal. So I read the script, and all I could say, Kevin, is what ensued is unbelievable. To this day, it blows my mind. We began an 8-month negotiation process with Stanley Kubrick and his attorney, Louis, and my stepfather. And it was amazing. At one point, Louis Blau called my father, Tom, and said to him, he had the commission of asking him, he wanted to know if Tom had read a book called Nuclear Negotiations. Because we literally was like an 8-month negotiation. Now, it was over isn't this crazy story?
Yeah.
It was over the money.
You can buy a house in less time than that. Well, less time.
Exactly. So it was just a really crazy, drawn out thing. And it was about money, but it wasn't. And then ultimately, I just decided against it. And I think at the time, my stepfather, my mother too, they were just concerned about if I was mentally there, capable of dealing with this
kind
of project.
How old were you at that point?
I'm 18. I was still a kid, but right. You know what I mean? But going there to go shoot a war movie. So cut to, it's a great film, and I love it to this day. And I love Matthew Modine. He's a good guy.
Was it close to the script that you read?
Yeah, it was. It was very interesting. It was. And then I run into Modine 2 years later. I'm like at the plaza, in front of walking by the plaza in New York City, and I see Modine, and we start talking. And I go, dude, by the way, how long did he wind up shooting on Full Metal Jacket? He goes, 54 weeks. 54 weeks.
Oh my God.
I mean, so Kubrick was really methodical, to say the least. And, you know, he really took
his
time.
We heard during the Eyes Wide Shut shoot how long that fucking took.
Same story. So really interesting. So to this day, I still admire Stanley Kubrick. I love him. I think about him as we all do. We love his films. He was just an innovator. I mean, they're just masterworks.
But wait, take me back. So he says that you're one of his favorite performers since seeing Jack in Five Easy Pieces.
And then I told Kelly that. And then that's when she called Jack. And then she took me up to Nicholson's house.
Kelly, oh my And this is what an 80 sentence.
I know. Kelly LeBrock. Like you. I'm not like, it's not lost on me, bro. I'm like, did this shit really happen to me?
What was that like? And this is Jack Nicholson circa what year? 80 what?
86. So prime, like Witches of Eastwood.
I was just going to say, Witches of Eastwood. Is it a mistake or did he do it on purpose?
My favorite line too. Oh, dude, we're on the same page. So again, life gets even more surreal. So now Kelly LeBrock, who's at the time married to a French gentleman named Victor Dre of Dre's, and if you know the Vegas, great guy. They wind up not being married for too long. It's irrelevant. She picks me up in a gold Corniche at the Sheraton premiere to take me to Nicholson's house.
Okay.
This shit is crazy. We drive up Mulholland, and Mulholland, if anybody's been here, it's like it sits atop the mountains and you can see like the valley and all of the city, and it's pretty cool. Windy road. We go through his gates. And Kevin, there's Nicholson, literally, dude, shooting free throws by himself, wearing a USA Olympic sweatshirt ensemble, right? So I turn around. Nicholson is literally firing off free throws in the driveway by himself. And you're like, dude, I mean, Nicholson's like my favorite. I love Nicholson to this day. So he does a fucking totally like one of these, Kevin, the open palm, pull the hair back like he does in all of his movies. All
right.
One of these, like you'd see in The Shining, and looks our way. He goes, come on in. I'm going to take a shower. I can't do it, Nicholson. He goes, come on in. I'm going to take a shower. I'll be down in a few minutes. Kelly parks the Rolls Royce. I'm like, I'm bugging out, dude. I'm 17, 18, right? Okay. Ding dong. We park the car. We come into like a cool, and it's not even like a big mansion. It was a pretty modest house, but we lived next to Brando. I didn't know at the time. But ding dong, we come in through the side entrance, kitchen door, and there's Angelica Houston at the door.
Oh, that's right. They're dating during all this, man.
Right. Right. But Jack had a lot of lady friends and the whole thing. Anyway, so Angelica Houston gives Kelly LeBrock kind of the side eye, but they kind of knew each other and they were like, yeah, come on in. She was gracious anyway. And so next thing you know, Angelica Houston leads us into Nicholson's living room. Okay, so if I can paint a picture of everybody for Jack's house, there's like beautiful paintings everywhere. Sinatra's playing low. Angelica Houston's like making dinner for him. Now Jack's in the shower. I'm bugging out. Okay, I'm like, okay. So then Kelly and I sit down in the living room. Angelica Houston disappears. Jack Nicholson comes down. Bro, this is hilarious. He sits down across from me, just like we're sitting here in your office here. Kelly's on my left. There is, like this, a beautiful silver, this is an ashtray, but there's like a silver dish sitting on the coffee table between us. I'll never forget this. It was ripped dollars, hundreds, twos, whatever it was, just ripped money. It was like an art piece. I'm going, wow, okay. Jack's got it like that. He's ripping up money. So 5 minutes later, Jack comes down. Dude, I swear to you, literally in what you're wearing, he's wearing a navy blue robe. He just took a shower. He literally does what you did. He picks up a dupe, fires it, tokes it, hands it to me. He goes, so Kelly told me you're going to be working with Stanley. You might have some questions. Dude, but watch this. So then the phone rings. He pops up and goes to get a call. Now, this is classic Jack, and I'll never forget this because this guy played for the Knicks. What was his name? Ray Williams. He was a guard. He pops up and starts talking basketball. And this one player, and what were his stats at St. John's before he went pro, and blah, blah, blah. And finishes that call, sits back down, and proceeds to tell me about working with Jack. Okay, so here's what he says. This is epic, dude.
Working with Stanley.
With Stanley, excuse me. Jack proceeds to tell me about working with Stanley on The Shining. He goes, well, you know, when we got there, you know, Shelley Duvall, you know, she was being a little, you know, she wanted things a certain way and she wanted to stay in London town and not out in the, you know, in the rural area where Stanley and the studio were, I guess, or whatever. And he proceeds to tell me about how they shot the movie. And he said it was minimum 30 takes a setup on The Shining.
Oh, my God.
So Kubrick was, you know, and I think there's been a lot, as you and I both know, as cinephiles, there's been a lot written about that. But I think you basically see Shelley Duvall coming undone during the making
when
of the
film. When you watch that documentary behind the scenes, he was, I mean, from my perspective, unnecessarily cruel. Like, at the end of the day, it's like, you know, if the actor's not giving you what you want, guess what? Fire the actor, get somebody else.
Right. Right.
But like that seemed like a real, I mean,
I hear you.
You can't argue with the results, I guess, in as much as it's a wonderful movie and she's great in it. Yeah. But like, you know, is anything worth
point taken? And the thing is, too, his sort of final note on Kubrick was he would do it again in a second.
Right.
But he was inferring some of what you just alluded to.
Right.
You know what I mean?
And so, we know, like, during Eyes Wide Shut, what was it? Harvey Keitel, like, was in it and then asked to come back for reshoots. And he was like, I'm not doing this. Wow. And so what was it?
Did he replace him with Pollock?
Sidney Pollock took over.
Who was great in that role.
It was wonderful.
Wow. So Keitel said, no, not enough.
Yeah, he had already been on camera. But it was one of these protracted, this has gone on for too long. I'm not doing this.
And you know what it makes me think? Again, that my parents loved me and cared because instinctively they knew that maybe I wasn't prepared mentally to deal with that, bro. You know what I mean? So that was just an interesting thing, man. But nonetheless, to this day, I really do. I think about him. I still study his films like you know, we study filmmakers and people that we love and their influence. But great experience.
You worked with one Batman director, and then years later, you worked with another Batman director in an actual Batman fucking picture. How'd you wind up Dark Knight?
Great point. Great setup from Tim Burton to Nolan.
Yeah.
So I auditioned for Nolan. He was there in the room with his wife back in 2007. He was great. He's very understated, very British. Has a great sense of humor. He's got this kind of cool smile. I read for another role, and then he basically did one of these, come back in, you might have another idea as you're reading an actor, and go, try this, and come back. We did that. And then I didn't hear anything for 2 months. So I think that was the circulation of the tapes and whatever. It's just letting the studio and everybody weigh in. And then I got the role, and it was a different role. It was the role of the newscaster. Nice little small part, all good. No small parts, only small actors. So I took
it
off.
And I was stoked. Also, a massive movie. No such thing as a small part. I would have played a fucking, a cop who gets drawn off of the
Me
bridge.
Too. I would have done fucking craft service on the Dark Knight if I could. So anyway, I finish up the Dead Zone. My crew was awesome. They were kind enough to the schedule was a little wonky and they basically backed me up and I was able to leave it a little bit early on my final season of the Dead Zone. I fly to London to start work on the Dark Knight. Amazing, amazing experience. Mm. So what can I tell you about that? Well,
wait, you had to go to London?
Yeah, I shot. It was actually the first day of production was my stuff in the news studio. And we shot it at a university that was not like Cambridge, but it was one of those really nice universities. It was about 90 miles outside of London town proper. So we shot there. And it was really funny. They were doing a thing where it was supposed to be a call-in that the Joker made that they had pre-taped with Heath's voice. But the tape kept fucking up. And so when we were shooting the scene and he was doing a slow push in on the other actor who's on my news set, I started ad-libbing as Heath and I did the voice, you know, whatever that effective. So he got a kick out of that. We had a laugh that day. But there's a funny moment. I got to tell you this. As a director, you'll love this. At one point later in the day, and I'm feeling cool. I'm like, oh, shit, this guy, they made Memento. I'm like making the fucking Dark Knight. This is crazy, dude, right?
And mind you, now everyone's like Chris Nolan is Chris Nolan. Memento was a cool movie. Insomnia was a cool movie.
Yeah.
Batman Begins was a cool movie, but it was not what The Dark Knight would become.
Thank you.
He would be like that with that movie, he took a massive fucking jump.
Thank you. Which then allowed him
into
to go
the
make
culture,
Interstellar and all these other great films. Absolutely. Right
Inception,
on the point.
Yeah.
So one day it was just a funny little story about an exchange we had. So I roll up on him and it was very austere, very British, just kind of looking ahead. And I kept, every time I would look at him, Kevin, I was like, this dude feels like Alfred Hitchcock. He felt like he was 75 years old. Right. I don't know what that means because he didn't look that way, but he just
carries himself like a wizened old man.
Well said. Okay.
Dumbledore.
Dumbledore. Totally. So I roll up on him. This is really, you're going to dig this as a filmmaker. I go, yo, Chris, who are some of your favorite directors? Dude. And this is the rhythm which he gave me his response. He didn't look at me, Kevin. He's just right here. Mm. And I could vibe that. So I wasn't waiting for him to look at me. I go, so Chris, who are your favorite filmmakers? He goes, Malick, Ridley, and then he goes, and Kubrick for a sense of control. I was like, peace out, dude. I'll see you at lunch. I think he was kind of fucking with me, but he literally said it like that. Deadpan, Malick, Ridley.
I don't know that he has a sense of humor, so I think you got the real answer right there. That dude lives and breathes the art, man.
He really does.
Film.
And he was cool. To be fair, he had laughs on set. I would see him. He was cool. But he would take the piss out of him, too, because I think he knows that he commanded that kind of air, not unlike a Hitchcock or something. But you're right on it. It was at the beginning of his ascent as this real auteur. You know? But I love Memento. Remember that movie, man?
It was wonderful. Great. Following is a great movie, too.
Yeah.
His very first thing he ever did. But
And he and his wife told me they did that on weekends with friends.
Yeah.
And it took a year and a half.
It was
only short ends.
I would assume the likes of Chris Nolan would not know who the fuck I am, except
he
gave an interview where he talked about following. He's like, in those days, Kevin Smith and Robert Rodriguez were making movies. So I said, why can't I? And shit. And I was like,
Isn't that great?
What is the, obviously we heard about the Nichols thing, which is
a cool story.
We can hear a very cool story. And we can hear that you were starstruck. Who else have you been starstruck over the years to have met in this business?
Oh, you know what? When I was a kid, I met De Niro a few times. He didn't have anything to say to anybody.
Right.
I read something in a book and it described him perfectly. He's very, because I'm actually kind of friends with his son, Rafael. He's a great guy. He's in real estate now. I read something about De Niro once and it nailed it perfectly. It's like he didn't really interact or talk because it was like a group dinner. And this is like in the late 80s and I'm just a punk kid sitting at a table. But the writer said he considers you. So De Niro, that's just like, at least when I was a younger kid, I mean, that he was just like, he just, not unlike how he looks at people in movies.
Yeah, that side eye kind of
thing. Yeah, totally, totally.
That's too funny.
But when I was growing up, dude, you know what it was, bro? It was like, it's that scene of Do the Right Thing. When Turturro was talking to Spike Lee, because my heroes were like Eddie Murphy and right. I loved Prince. I always loved Prince. I thought I was a huge Prince fan. I just thought he was a genius musically. So as a kid, back to SNL, dude, I was at home in the 70s watching SNL. And in high school, when Eddie blew up, I loved Eddie, man. I still do.
When I think of you on SNL, I think of you and Damon Wayans, who was also on that season as well, right. together. I remember you guys doing a sketch where you were like zoning out.
We were two junkies.
Right.
But by the way, back to Standards and Practices, we couldn't say it, so we called it the Two Joneses. You weren't allowed to say junkies in 1985.
Are you TV. Fucking shitting me?
I swear
me?
To God, dude.
So was that meant to be a recurring? Was it a recurring?
It kind of was. Get a recurring? It kind of was. It was also based on the old Crazy Eddie spots.
That's why it was kind of like
Jersey. Yes, yeah, of course, yeah. So it was kind of based on that, Kevin. And
it was
also,
you nodding out during the spot,
right? We're both like on the nod, trying to be like Crazy Eddie and sell TVs. That was the gimmick. Yeah, right. So it was funny. And Damon was really a great guy, man. He was hilarious. We had an inside joke between us because this is really funny. I got to tell the story because he went on to great success. He got fired on SNL, and here's why. It was 1985. Griffin Dunne was hosting.
Okay.
And at the time, Miami Vice was the shit. Remember, it was like bigger than the movie business, the TV show Miami Vice.
Yeah, huge, huge.
So Griffin and the writers had written a sketch for Griffin and for Damon to play Crockett and Tubbs.
All right.
Damon was not having it, dude. He just felt because he would start out, say, what Lorne does, it's like the farm league. So when you're a featured player, right. you're not in the cast, but you're on the show. So it's like the farm league being integrated with the big league.
Right.
So he wasn't happy with it. He kind of made that known to Lorne, and he did something on air which fucked everybody up. What he wound up doing on Living Color when he came out in Men on Film with his brother.
Yeah, and he
played it very gay and over the top. And hilarious. He did that live. And so he played Tubbs or Crockett? Crockett and Tubbs.
He played it effeminate?
Yes.
Without telling anybody?
Right. He got fired the next day.
I mean, let's talk about why.
That's kind of wild.
Because
had nothing to do with him playing gay or whatever. And he threw Lorne for a curve. He threw a curve at him because he basically he changed the performance and he played it like he did on Men on a Film, which was pretty, I thought it was hilarious, but he wound up getting fired, unfortunately.
Now, what happens in a moment like that, like for everyone else, like is Griffin Dunne mad?
I don't remember because I wasn't in the sketch. I was probably backstage, Kevin, or in the rooms, you know.
But Lorne would be the one who would get the maddest because it's his show.
I'm not speaking. Like, I can't speak to his response because I never actually saw it. But I think it obviously pissed him off. Yeah, exactly. It pissed Lorne off. But the irony of that is that he goes on to create Living Color with his brother, and they were just great. And that was one of the most popular sketches when he and his brother would do the two gay guys, you know, doing film reviews. It was hilarious.
What was, you know, they talk about those SNL, like, after parties and shit. Were they still doing, like, Caroline?
Oh, it's incredible. Like? Yeah. It would be, like, whatever the hipster restaurant was in Soho at the time, which was a new spot. The end of the year party was sick, too, because we'd do it right before the break in the year, before we'd come back in the spring, because we'd do it at the rink. Downstairs at 30 Rock, you know, and parties were sick. You'd work 6 days a week on that show. You'd do the show twice. You probably learned from other
from like the rehearsal show, right? And then live,
and then the party. Everybody looked forward to the parties, man. And it was just
and
like,
you're a teenager, awesome. So you must have really been looking forward to the party.
Of course, loving it, man. So you'd be up till 6 a.m. on Sunday morning, you know.
But by episode 13, you were able to duck out and go do the floor.
Yeah, and then quite honestly, I wasn't really asked back. So I think that I got a lot of heat off of your
announcement too. Like when they announced, it was like that was a big. Well, number one, Lorne coming back. And number two, bringing established performers.
And in all fairness, you know, like I wish
I could. You and Randy were in Vacation as well.
Right. Vacation together. Right. Another connection. Yeah.
That's fucking crazy.
But Lauren, I mean, I my hat's off to him. I was so honored that I got the call. I was honored to have worked for him. He created that format, as you got, as you know, man. Yeah. And he's just, he was great. He was very generous. A great guy to work for. He would take us to Yankee games. He took Downey and I and Nicholson to a Yankee game one night. He was a diehard Yankee fan.
The fuck kind of childhood did you have?
Dude, it was surreal. It was literally surreal.
Did Hughes ever come see you on SNL?
No, because at that time, John was very a guy who liked to stay close to home. And what had happened, Kevin, is he moved out to LA after his initial success with the films that I was a part of.
Mm-hmm.
Had the big studio deal, moved to Brentwood.
Did he really?
Yeah. And then I can't say how long, but he just it wasn't for him. So about a year or two, maybe later, he moved back to Chicago.
Where, from what I understand, like anytime I've gone there to do press or, yeah. or events, you know, from the beginning of my career, I was mm-hmm. always like, who knows Hughes? Like, I was always looking for info
cool.
and shit.
Cool.
That dude built an infrastructure for production, like, and owns a piece of it and owned pieces of stages. People were telling me, like, he didn't just write and direct movies. He was a smart cookie.
He was, man. He really was. And I think it ultimately just, like, he just reverted back to Chicago where he was from. He was comfortable that way.
Do you
the other
remember
thing he know, this is just a side note. He loved Beamers. He always had new BMWs.
Is that right?
And I remember just like every time I got one of his cars, it was like he had three of them at all times. He was awesome. He loved BMWs. But anyway.
Do you remember the last time you talked to him?
Okay. This is another cool story. 1988 or 89. Okay. He calls me with John Candy.
Oh my God.
And Kevin, we just sat on the phone for like 2.5 hours, like the three of us. They were just bullshitting. It's like we were all in the same room. And he talked about doing a remake or sequel to The Breakfast Club when they were, you know, if they were older at that point. At the time, we were in our 20s. So I think it interested him to kind of pick up on that, whether we were in our 20s or 30s or whatever. So that was just one thing that came up. But what's interesting is
was he shooting Uncle Buck at this point? Or was he just
well, he must have done The Great Outdoors because at that
that's
point,
right.
What happened was he and John's family, they really did become great friends and they really did take family vacations together. And that's what the outdoors,
family
Great Outdoors was.
And the Candy family?
Which becomes the impetus for The Great Outdoors.
Is that right?
Yeah. So Aykroyd's playing Hughes and Candy's playing himself because they would take vacations together as families.
And Hughes was like the Aykroyd-y obnoxious character?
Well, my point being, it was based on their friendship and
right.
that they would take family vacations together.
Right, right.
And it was subsequent to Uncle Buck, right? So I think Great Outdoors is after that, if I'm not mistaken.
I think you're right. Yeah.
If not.
So yeah. They met on Uncle Buck and then he like was just friends. Like, so the same way he like took a shine to you, took a shine to Molly, took a shine to Macaulay yeah. Culkin. He yeah. took a shine to like John Candy.
Definitely.
He made a couple movies with him.
He did. And John Candy, man, to this day, Kevin, hands down, one of the nicest people I've ever met in my life. Valerie Harper, for whatever reason, just came to mind. I worked with her on Touched by an Angel. Also, like, there are people you meet in your life that they come out of themselves and they're bigger than what you might know their fame to be or whatever.
Right.
John Candy was like that. He was awesome and he was wonderful. We shot Vacation. We were at Magic Mountain. Now, this is a quick Vacation story. It was funny. The original ending was not at the park. The original ending had us going to Roy Wally's house, who was played by the great Eddie Bracken.
Yeah, who's in the movie briefly when he's like, well, what's going on here? He comes to the park.
The original ending is we kidnapped him and we hijacked him at his house in Bel Air. And the original final ending of the movie was we interrupt him at a business lunch poolside at his Malibu estate. That's the original ending. So cut to, they test screen the movie. And everybody was like,
so
wait a minute.
You guys shot that ending?
Yes, we shot it. The audience didn't like it. So we shot that ending. They screened it. They loved the movie. But everybody, now this is where the cards come in because
yeah.
Warners was smart. They were probably one of the first studios to do that. The test screenings, right? They came back and everybody said unanimously, we want to see them get to the fucking park. They never made it to Wally World. Cut to 9 months later.
We
reshot the ending, which is the ending and it's it.
So in your original version that
you never
shot,
made it to Wally World.
Are you fucking kidding
I
me?
I swear to you. It was at Eddie Bracken's, or excuse
Walt
me, Roy,
house.
Right, Walt Disney's house, who he's playing.
Because, so you got to the park was closed, and then they were
not
like,
even that.
You didn't even get as far as getting to the park and racing to
no,
the front?
No, we didn't. We literally went, oh, excuse me, wait a minute, that had to be there.
Yeah, because it's closed, and then right. You're like, we want justice. So instead of going to buy a pellet gun, you went to
but
the fucking-
it might have been the other way too, Kev, because the way I remember it is we shot that entry where we arrive and it's closed the same day we shot getting
the
in.
Other stuff right.
So I think so whatever it was, but basically the original ending was we go to Roy Wally's house and hijack a business lunch poolside, stick him up at gunpoint, And then he calls it off like, oh, he's a good guy after all. We won't prosecute.
The same thing essentially happens. I got the
you got
park.
It. So they transferred that bit and then they rewrote the ending and then they hired Candy and it became us taking the rides.
So
the
Candy park. Was never in it never up until that it. Point.
You got it.
And that's the first Candy Hughes crossover, even though they also didn't work together.
Bingo.
How fucking strange.
Isn't that cool? Man. So we shot that ending later, and it was funny because puberty kicked in.
Magic Mountain,
like
right? And you guys shot the end at Magic Mountain.
That's right.
Wait, so if you go back and look at it, you look different?
Literally, you'll see it.
Is that
I'm
right?
I'm like blonde and about 5'2", and all of a sudden I'm like 5'8" with a big pimple on my chin. Scrawny legs, the whole shit. So, and then the other thing, which is a really funny kind of side note, is I'm the only one who could fit with John, God bless him.
In the car.
Even Dana Barrett, who's a friend to this day.
Well, you were wispy.
I was wispy. Yeah.
Where he's like, don't do that.
He was so cool too, Kevin, because we get to the set and I remember just joking because John and I would always laugh. We'd watch SCTV together because we were fans of his before he worked with John on this movie. And I remember the Schmengi brothers. Remember that?
Yeah, of course.
The Schmengi brothers, Josh and Stan Schmengi. They talk like this.
So basically, I told John the day that I met him at Magic Mountain that cracked me up. And he was such a sweetheart. He just would make me laugh. And he goes,
okay, Mike, we're going to make you an honorary Schmengi. You're going to be Linsk Schmengi. That's right. Josh, Stan, and Linsk Schmengi.
So he was Uncle Buck, dude. He was like, just great.
And fucking Eugene Levy was in that movie, too. You acted with Eugene Levy. You're in the fucking scene with the car.
We shot that in Burbank, the car dealership. Yeah.
Easy, Russ. Where's my car? Yeah.
And even that wasn't lost on me. He was another legend. I loved him.
Yeah, he came from SCTV. He was a Schmengi. God damn
it. Great stuff, huh?
Fucking storied career, man. When do you write the book?
I got more movies to make, man. I thought about that, but I mean, I'm 53 now. I'd like to wait a while. I feel like I really want to do a lot more, you know.
Well, I mean, you could definitely do more, but still fucking write the book.
I think I will eventually. Man.
Heavens, because you've think about it. You've got a chart from pre-10 to now. That's like 40 plus years.
I'm also thinking of like a show, like a one-man show. I'm working on developing that, actually.
You would, honestly, I'm sitting here listening to you talking. This is something that like is not. It's not a thing. I rarely hear you out there in the world doing interviews.
I know. I've often, kind of veered from it. You know, what's interesting is that, first of all, I have a friend, he and his wife, they're in Vegas. They have a club called Fremont Country Club, and they're building a hotel. So my friend Carlos and my friend Ava, we're in talks about doing that. I'd like to maybe do a one-man show. So we're developing that.
God, yes. You could easily sit there and tell stories, man, because even just sitting here, you got them well structured, they're fun, and it's like, oh my god,
the signings. Like I've learned that over the years, like doing these
when you do the Q and A's,
exactly, and that's what really got me sharp and just telling and sharing this stuff with people.
Is that right on the concert?
Yeah, it's fun.
That's the kind of same thing here, like doing the Q and A's after film festival screenings on the concert, like.
So what I did is I put together a pop-up tour last summer. We went to Texas, my wife and I, and I partnered with a company called Evo.
Yeah.
And I did like a mini film festival of my own stuff. And then I brought in Robert Patrick. We did Aliens. Downey showed up. We screened Johnny B. Goode and one of our other, and Weird Science. Sean Astin's a buddy. We screened Goonies and some other stuff.
Fucking
A. So from that gave me the idea to do a pop-up tour during COVID. And we went, my wife and I, to Texas, and we did one for 6 weeks. It was great.
Fucking
so,
A.
So that kind of thing, too, of kind of morphing that, right? When COVID came, we're like, what the fuck are we going to do?
What do we do now?
And then we put that together.
But also, it's just like you have a commodity that most people in this world don't have. Most people, like, we live in the age of the podcast where anybody will listen to almost anybody and stuff. But there's so many of them, not everyone gets listened to.
Yeah.
You would fucking get listened to because, like, you've got boots on the ground experience of eras that still mean something and transform the culture.
Like, I appreciate
that. And you're fucking so well spoken. You can sit there and hold fucking court. I can see you standing, being in a chair, leaning in Dave Chappelle style on a fucking stool.
Right, right.
And literally doing like an hour, 2 hour show, man, where
totally
you just tell fucking story.
I'm developing it. Yeah. Smart. I'm thinking to do it in Vegas. Yeah. It'd be fun. No, I appreciate that so much. Coming from you, man, it means a lot. Thank you. Yeah, because here's the thing. Like, yourself, heavily influenced. Like, my heroes growing up were Carlin and Richard Pryor.
Yes.
Like, really. And then I discovered Lenny. So even though I've never done stand-up, I love comics. I love comedians.
Yeah, but you also, like, even though you've never, quote-unquote, done stand-up, you've got comedic chops. A comedic actor has timing and stuff like that.
So that's why I think the show would be an interesting thing. Because my father, it's actually interesting. Tom discovered Leguizamo. So if you look at people who have done that kind of thing, I like that kind of approach too.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, it's an honor. Thank you, man. Yeah.
Happy to do it. That or the book, but I do think live spoken word performance, on stage. Absolutely, yeah. Man.
I'm talking audio visual elements would be cool too.
Fucking A.
Yeah. So we're working on.
What was, when you were running around with the movies and stuff like mm-hmm. that, what did Sean Astin show? Goonies
and Rudy. And he's a great guy. We did a movie a couple of years back, Kevin, with the great Bruce Dern, and it was called The Lears. And it was a Canadian director named Carl Bassai, who was a friend, great guy. We shot this movie, and he really is like a Cassavetes. We shot this movie in a house in Malibu for 3 weeks, and I did it after I finished Live by Night with Ben Affleck, your buddy.
Yeah.
And
that's right. Fucking you.
Yeah.
That's right.
So I worked with Sean on that. He's a great guy. So he showed up. We actually had to zoom him in because he and Downey were still at home with their families, and I respected that. But Robert Patrick is a game on dude. He's awesome. He got on his bike, dude, and drove to Texas.
And came out into
the
world.
And we did like a Terminator weekend with him and Eddie Furlong and some other guys. It was great, man. So we had a great run.
You still talk to RDJ?
Yeah, we're good, man. We're very close friends. He just texted me the other day congratulating me on Hollywood Kills. And we have a TV show that we wrote called Singularity, which I've been developing with he and his wife at their company. And we did a first round of pitch to some networks, but we're still hot on that one too. So we wrote a TV show together.
Now this is a guy who you've known for years and you've known him he's a actor who likes to bury in roles. Mm-hmm. When you see him play Iron Man for the first time and you see him play essentially what most of us assume is so close to self.
Mm.
Do you see it that way? Or when you look and play Iron Man, you're like, oh, that's still a performance.
I see that. I see that what you're saying. And here's what I would say to that. There's a parallel I would
draw. And it's not a diss.
No, not at all. No, no, no. I know.
Tony Stark, one of the greatest characters ever created. And the fact that he seemingly plays it so close to himself is what makes it even more enjoyable.
I love it. No, there's a couple things I want to say about that. Years ago, I read a book, and it was called Directors on Directing. Peter Bogdanovich was asked, what is the first thing you notice about an actor? And he said his or her intelligence. So with Downey, someone like that, he's always had that brilliance, that mind. Mm, he's so great.
He's fucking sharp.
And to your question, I think that's a good point. This is where I'd compare him to Depp. And this is something that Robert said to me when I was blowing him up. We were on a call. This was probably 6-7 years ago. And I was just congratulating him on the greatest comeback in the history of Hollywood. Let's call it what it is.
Very true.
And his wife is an amazing woman. She really is.
She's a big part of that comeback.
Susan, she is a huge part of it. Yes, sir. Absolutely.
He's a,
but you know what he said?
He's a energies guy, very positive energies guy, crystals guy.
Totally. Yeah. And is really doing great. They have two kids together and Indio, my godson, his son is in his 20s now. But here's something that Downey said to me. He goes, well, and in response to the compliment I was giving him that day on our call, he's like, well, if you do 75 movies, one of them's got to work. So he was just kind of, being self-deprecating, but not unlike Depp. The guy does 75, 100 performances that are mind-blowing and then gets Pirates of Silicon Caribbean, excuse me. And then case in point for Downey, too. So there's an argument to be made, like he's so talented that he doesn't have to do much to be charming as Stark. But let's not forget the 75 great films, right? Like all the great work.
Like
in the last 30
when you
years.
Watch Chaplin, you never see Robert Downey Jr.
Thank you.
When you watch Iron Man, you can't help but see Robert Downey Jr. For us, Tony Stark and Robert Downey Jr. are one. And that was part of the charm of the character in the first one, like why Favreau was smart to cast him, because it's like you're casting a celebrity
as a billionaire
movie,
right, exactly,
who also had a dad who was in the business before, like everything lined up so nicely.
And I think like Depp in a different way, virtuoso actor, man, he can go left to right, he can go comedy, drama, anything you throw at him. And then look at Depp, I mean, Willy Wonka, I mean, the guy is like he can do anything, Johnny Depp.
Oh yeah, I've seen it point blank. He was in Tusk. We made this movie called Tusk and Yoga Hosers, and he was
cool.
Crazy. He loves doing the makeup.
Yeah.
But yeah, my God, man, that's
cool stuff, man.
A couple guys that you fucking were. I forgot about the depth.
So to me, yeah, exactly. It's like that trajectory, that much work and putting down that much work, dude, it's awesome. They deserve everything that comes to them. And I have nothing but respect for those guys. Guys we talked about earlier too, like Christian Bale, love that guy, man. Heath Ledger, I loved working with him. I admired all these guys that I've been able to work with. Depp's another one. Incredible actor.
When you work with these cats, because you've got most of them by like 5 to 10 years at least, are they all like me where they're like, what the fuck was Hughes like? What the fuck was this like? What the fuck was
I have to admit, a lot of people are interested in John, because there was a part of John, Kevin, that was almost like Howard Hughes.
Yeah.
And I think...
Very reclusive. Like, it seems like the only way I ever find out about him is from people who literally touched the hem and were part of his life, like yourself.
And like you're saying, man, like after when I told you that bit about he went to LA and then just decided to go back, he didn't really feel comfortable here. So I think from that time on,
a squirrel just coming in and taking a awesome. Nut.
What's going on? Squirrel looking for a nut. He got one.
He did.
That's hilarious. So yeah, with John, I think, you know, I think he became increasingly like more like that and kind of distanced himself from the world. And that's okay. You know, because I think there was an introverted aspect to him that was deeply private, and that's cool.
And the thing is, you know, he shared that, like the fact that he shared as much as he did, considering he was something of an introvert,
totally.
And so much of his life, you know, his youth, but translating it to kids who were 15, 20 years younger than him.
And also
so important. He talked to us like we were adults, like the way you got to hang out with him. Yeah. We all didn't get to hang out with him. But for those of us who watched his movies, we appreciated that he spoke to us like we were not fucking children. Like he knew we were people too.
Great point. And I think that level of sensitivity, awareness, all of those things, he never lost that. I think that was part of his ear as a writer. But, you know, like there's a moment in The Breakfast Club, and this is actually pretty poignant, where John Kaplos is a buddy of mine. He was in a film that I produced this summer called The Class, which is kind of like a reimagined modern day Breakfast Club.
He was the janitor.
He played the janitor.
He was also in 16 Candles. Correct. He was the one marrying Molly Ringwald's sister.
Yeah. And he's also in Weird Science. So he's the other actor.
He's in one of my favorite movies. Oh my God. That's right. He's in Weird Science too. He's also in, Nothing in Common with Tom Hanks.
Oh, that's right. He's a great actor. Good guy. And so, I just wanted to highlight one thing in the scene with Gleason.
Yeah.
Where Gleason's being interviewed by Kaplos as the janitor.
Yeah.
I'm the eyes and ears of this institution. Yeah, he says something. Gleason turns to him and goes, well, who were your heroes growing up? Who did you want to be? And when Capullo responds, John Lennon, that's John. John was a huge Beatles fan. So there again, he would project elements or pieces of his life onto the other characters. I happen to know because I talked to John about it. He had sisters, so he kind of felt like the black sheep between two sisters.
Mm-hmm.
So that kind of true sensitivity and awareness and self-awareness that informed his writing, I think that he maintained that kind of kid's heart. And that's why it's kind of sad that I lost track and touch with him, because I think it really offended him and hurt him more than I realized when I wasn't able to do those films. And it would have been five in a row that I had done with him. But
what films?
Ferris Bueller and Pretty in Pink he wanted me to star in.
Hold on. Rolled over that. Is that right?
Yeah. He wrote Ferris Bueller for me, actually, not Matthew Broderick. Yeah.
Get the fuck out. Yeah. That makes absolute sense.
Yeah.
That tracks.
Right.
And then what was the other one?
Well, Pretty in Pink, which I felt, to be very honest, it's very much 16 Candles.
Yeah, it is. That's
true. It's
kind
of a repeat of it. So because I was working on some other stuff and just it didn't work out.
Oh, my God. John Cryer must thank the Lord the day that you were like, I've done this before.
Yeah. He's a nice guy.
He's like, thank God.
Yeah.
Because he got to be Ducky.
Yeah. No, he's a nice guy.
So wait, so this happened with Molly as well, from what I understand. Like she was offered parts and she was like, I'm going to grow up. And then he was just kind of done with her.
So back to the sensitivity and the capability as an artist that he has to hear and write the way he always did. Same thing. He was had a very sensitive way about it.
Yeah.
And I think that might have been, in fact, how it played out, that he was upset or angered with both of us or me.
I raised you kids. I brought you in kind of thing.
And yet there was total equanimity when we were together because, like I said, we were like two 15-year-olds hanging out.
Right. He wasn't like, I'm the guy who made you. Yeah. You were like buddies.
But I'm sure you have that kind of rapport with your actor friends, right? Because they become friends and you just
– And I also get
– that dialogue.
I get sensitive if, like, you know, one of them was – you know, like we were going to make Zach and Miri make a porno. We had made Clerks 2.
I loved it.
Thank you. We were about to make Zach and Miri make a porno. Yeah. And I offered it to Rosario, who we had just done Clerks 2 with, and she was wonderful in Clerks 2. So I was like, you and Seth Rogen.
Yeah.
And, you know, she was like, I love you, but I literally just played this part for you. She's like, this is the same – character kinda in the same relationship kinda and I was like, oh yeah, you're right. So
thanks. You
got
to you.
But I wasn't like, I'm done with you.
right.
But there was a feeling of like, oh well, yes, but still,
right,
will you do it? And I'm sure like he bumped into that
maybe. Yeah, so it's a kind of a weird unknown when it comes to Hughes, but I love him, I loved him, I miss him, you know. And his wife was so great because really, man, like I was at his house a lot. I was always hanging out with him. And the things that I recounted earlier, Kevin, like true. Like he would pick us up. We'd go to record stores. We'd go see music.
What's the closest of all the Hughes movies? Because he put himself into lots of the main characters. Is She's Having a Baby the closest to him? He certainly looks like young Hughes with the glasses.
I think there's that because I know for a fact, like, remember in the 80s when we were kids, there was that commercial. It was like for shaving cream where the guy tested his beard with a credit card.
Yeah.
John wrote that.
Are you fucking shitting me? John Hughes wrote that card.
Remember that?
The credit card commercial.
In the early 80s, it was like, you test your beard with the credit card.
Yeah.
And it was for whatever shaving cream, right? Or a razor, one of the other.
How fucking nuts.
So in terms of, to answer your question, I think from the macro standpoint, yeah, that's his life because he was an ad guy in Chicago.
Right.
Falling in love with his lovely, beautiful wife. And she was a beautiful woman. And they had two great kids that are great guys. So yeah, but now having worked with him, dude, I think he did that all through his career. Yeah. Like Easter eggs of either his own biography or...
He left little horcruxes everywhere. Little pieces of himself.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that we were all conduits to that. Like we were all channeling aspects of him, I think. Not just Molly and I. That's my thought, maybe.
It's so crazy, dude, because you're a giant who's walked with giants. You know what I'm saying? Like, as you recount tales, you're our way into the story, the audience, but the audience can't also forget you're also one of the main characters in the stories that you're bringing us into. Like, you're not in the room as one of us, like, oh, we just happen to be standing by and fucking cool famous people happen. You were in the room because of the talent and the fucking chops that you had and continue to fucking have.
Thank you,
I'm
sir.
Telling you right That's now, awesome, man. If you Thank don't do a one-man show, it's a complete waste of a fantastic storytelling ability, Thanks. Great fucking voice, fucking pitch-perfect timing, Thanks. And you've got content for fucking days.
No, it's true. I really appreciate that, Kevin. It reminds me of, I want to finish my point that I alluded to earlier about why I think Tim Burton is Scissorhands.
Mm.
When we're doing the film, okay, first of all, I go in his office. This is a trip. And the drawings behind him for Nightmare Before Christmas are on the wall. So he was an animator. Not to mention that he looked like one of the lost members of The Cure, right? He had the hair.
Yes.
His favorite actor was Vincent Price, the great. So, and then you look at that story and it's kind of a fairy tale. It's like, what is it? Pinocchio and Romeo and Juliet, everything, right? Mm-hmm. So, but Tim Burton was another one. No, man, I love it. I've often thought of that saying, Kevin. It actually matters a lot to me personally, which is, you know, standing on the shoulders of giants, and that we, in our lives, all of us have had those people that impacted us. You've been that to many people too. You have a whole generation of actors that you've been that to.
Sometimes.
And yeah, man. So isn't it cool? It's like a really gives me chills in a way because it's cool. But I also think it's like the way it's supposed to be. In terms of the evolution of things.
Very true.
Because like what I learned from Maddie and Harold, and you know, and hopefully as a director and producer in the future, I can do that for others, you know.
You've had an astounding, you continue to have an astounding career. Thanks, it's also man. Fucking amazing that you made it out of the 80s as a teen actor alive.
No, it's true.
Happy, healthy, with fucking love and a family and shit like that.
Thank you, man.
God bless. That's awesome. Smile bless, as we say around here.
Smile bless, right on.
Man, oh man, Halloween Kills is out right now. What are you doing, Halloween Kills?
Okay, so I played Tommy Doyle in the original. That was one of the two kids.
Wait, what?
Yeah.
Are you shitting me?
That's Tommy Doyle.
You're the little boy that she's babysitting.
You got it. Who says you can't kill the boogeyman in the first?
Yeah.
Oh, bro, you got to see the movie. I got to come back. We'll do it again after you see Halloween Kills. You got to see this movie, dude.
Oh my God.
We can talk about that movie.
It ties into the first one, not too close.
Oh my God. But not only that, can I just give props to David Gordon Green, Danny McBride, Jason Blum, and my boss, Jamie Lee. Dude, this movie kicks ass.
I interviewed her on the IMD boat at San Diego Comic Con.
She's so chill.
Lovely.
Man. She's really a great person and really has digested, I think, the lessons of her life. She's very caring and generous of others.
Somebody who's really been in the business like a minute longer than you.
Too. Oh my God.
So she is your kind of
big time.
Like,
but I just want to say, like, he did such a great job in this movie because going into it, I hadn't seen the other 11. Like, I really only saw the first one.
Are there 11 Halloween movies?
This is the 12th installment. But when I was shooting it, Kevin, I got to be honest, man, like in the first 2 weeks after doing a bunch of stuff that I did and seeing how David Gordon Green and Michael Simmons as DP and meeting Danny McBride. I mean, dude, I love that guy. I love them. And I remember calling my wife going, I think this is going to be like the best, if not up there at the top of all these films. And I didn't even see the other 10.
Right.
But I just felt it, man. And I'm just so pumped. People are loving it, man. It's made like $92 million in 12 days.
It's doing business. It's in an era when everyone's terrified to leave that.
And what David Gordon Green, who by the way, reminds me a lot of John in many ways, totally affable, cool, collaborative, great guy. He was talking to me about it when we were on set, you know, like Tommy's the hero of the film, you know, but in fairness to my other actors, the arc he gave me is the one that we all share. So everybody kind of transcends being just the victim or the survivors. And the way the movie kicks off, Rose, it picks up right from the last one.
Mm.
The house is on fire. We are all commiserating in this town, having a little friendly night, Halloween night with the locals. And I get up and I start talking about those that we've lost and all that. And then everybody just kind of rises up. Now, what's crazy is this predates everything that our world has been through for the last 2 years. We shot the movie 2.5 years ago.
Is that right? Oh, that's right. This was being held all through quarantine.
And the code name of the film was Mob Rules. And we had no idea, like all the stuff that's happened in the world. It's the thing of like life imitating art to some people who choose to interpret that way. I don't look at it like that, but some people do.
How ironic.
But the movie kicks ass, man. Like David Gordon Green did such a great job. So I'm just so proud to be in this movie. It's just like this, dude. It's like a roller coaster. You're going to love it when you see it.
And that's high praise from a fucking guy who's been, who's worked with a director or two, including some of the fucking giants of our industry. And not just like old giants who have left us, but fucking Nolan and Burton, dude, are pillars.
They are. Of this They really are. Yeah. No, I appreciate that so much. It's a great experience, Halloween Kills.
Yeah, no shit.
Yeah.
Good for you, man.
Thanks,
man. Halloween Kills is still in theaters right now, also on Peacock for a minute streaming. If I don't know if they're doing it like HBO Max does, where they do it for a month and take it off, but you can check it out there right now. And God willing, if Anthony Michael Hall gets his shit together, he'll be on a stage next year doing a fucking show that you can go see, talking about his life and work. I'm telling you, I'd pay to see that show. I'd buy a ticket for that.
I love you for the support, bro. And also, like yourself, I want to get behind the camera and start directing. So I'm developing. I have a company, Manhattan Films.
Have you ever directed across
the I directed an episode. It was so funny. I got Richard Lewis to guest star on it. And he was playing kind of a Howard Stern character when I did The Dead Zone. I directed that. I directed a movie that was goofy as shit when I was 25 called Hail Caesar.
Hail Caesar! I remember Downey that fucking picture. Yeah. And you directed
and I
that.
I did. Yeah, Sam Jackson. I got. Yeah, you know, we were kind of scriptless, but we had fun anyway. And so, you know, I have a project that I wrote that I want to direct. I'm developing my company's with Manhattan Films because I consider that my great teacher. Or I grew up in Manhattan,
right?
And yeah, just gunning, man. I have some good stuff in the works. I have a couple things going to be announced soon. But yeah, so like yourself, I want to direct comedies. I want to make other kinds of films and. And also, I really endeavor to have a company because I want to help others. It can't be just about yourself. So, you know, that's the plan. It's moving ahead. I have a lot to do. I feel that way.
Fuck yeah. We all loved Farmer Ted. Farmer Ted grew up okay, man.
Thanks, man.
you and I will do something together.
I would love it, Kevin.
In a heartbeat.
I'd love to work
I'm telling you, you are in my creative DNA because I grew up watching
your
work. So it's like fundamentally, yes.
Well, I've always been a huge fan, and I love how you handle your world too, man. You're a great filmmaker. You're a great guy, and people love you, and I'm happy to be here with you, man.
Thank you.
Yeah.
There it is, kids. Fucking talking with a titan here, ladies and gentlemen. Talking with the three names that matter most in this world. Anthony Michael Hall, thank you for making the time.
Thank you,
coming
Kevin,
over,
for having
man. Excellent.
Real pleasure.
Thanks, pleasure. That is Smodcast this week, kids. I'm Kevin Smith.
I'm Anthony Michael Hall.
Have a week. See ya.
This has been a Smodco Internet production. Sip. Only at smodcast.com.